Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Firstly, doing a topic of changes in January, that is like some, oh my God, major self-punishment going on here.
Hello, I am Annie McManus. Welcome to Changes. This is a place where we uncover stories of change. My guest today is Travis Alabanza. What a name and what a person. Travis is a performance artist and a playwright, first and foremost. And Travis identifies as Black, trans, feminine and gender non-conforming. They were born in Bristol and grew up in Hillfields, a council estate area outside of the city, with their mum and their brother. Travis has experienced all of the prejudice and abuse you could experience as a trans person, but Travis has channeled all of that into their art in a really effective and impactful and powerful way. Their plays talk about the lived experience of being trans. Burgers tells the story of Travis getting a burger thrown at them when they were walking across Waterloo Bridge and being called a tranny and how no one came to their aid. Their most recent play, Overflow, which has had huge ticket sales at the Bush Theatre, is the story of a trans woman kind of trapped in a toilet cubicle, and it's a whole monologue from their perspective in there. Travis is also a person who is used to now achieving a lot of firsts, breaking a lot of boundaries. They're the youngest person to be awarded a residency at the Tate, the youngest ever leader of an artist in residence workshop at the Tate, and the first Black trans person to sell out a show at the South Bank Centre. Travis was awarded Future Fighter at the Gay Times Honours Awards and has had work featured at the V&A as well. We talk about all of their work in this conversation and the huge changes they've experienced in life, from first starting to dress how they wanted to, attending a summer camp in the US and learning about pronouns for the first time, dropping out of university to be an artist, and becoming a trans voice in the art world. They're very charming, very funny, and I really enjoyed this conversation with them. Here's what happened when we Zoomed on a gloomy Thursday morning in January. Enter the podcast, Travis Alabanza. So, Travis, hello and welcome to Changes.
Hi, thanks for having me.
It's great to have you. I'm really chuffed that you're here and I thank you for your time. How has time been for you at the start of 2021?
Well, I'm celebrating the 72nd day of January right now, so I feel all right. I think that's how time's been going for me. I quit smoking at the top of the year, as I do every year, and this feels like it's been the 700th day without a cigarette, so that's what time is like.
How are you doing? Have you read that? Have you read that Alan Carr book?
No, but I feel like what I'm doing is just... every ex-smoker is telling me like sentences at a time when I tell them. So instead of reading it, everyone's just recommending it to me in chunks.
Okay, I will stop doing what I was just about to do, which is tell you my one line that I always carry.
No, what is the line? What is the line?
Well, it's basically about changing your perceptions of like, of what cigarettes do for you. So it's like, instead of like them helping you or making you feel better, it's the idea of you being liberated from them. So it's like, actually, your whole way of thinking about them, like giving them up as a sacrifice, you need to switch it on your head and think, actually, giving them up is liberating me. I am now free of them. And it's just an interesting way. It's like, it's not anything about the physicality of it. It's just how we frame our minds to think about them. Really interesting.
I think I'm gonna have to get the book.
Honestly, it really helped me.
Okay.
Yeah, cool. Yeah. Anyway, well done to you, giving up fags, like at this time of the year, like when there's nothing happening and we're in a global pandemic.
It feels really silly and not congratulatory. And I feel like I've lost my personality trait, basically.
This podcast is about change. Obviously, we've asked you to think about a couple of questions before you come. And I wanted to get to the first change now. So talking about a change that you experienced, you know, early in your life, what have you brought to us?
Yeah, firstly, doing a topic of changes in January, that is like some, oh my God, major self-punishment going on here.
Babe, I'm so sorry.
But I love it.
We launched this podcast basically in February of last year. Like, just as the world changed irrevocably. Like, it was like, did someone, like, what the fuck? Like, it was so weird. So, yeah, I'm sorry to hit you with that in January.
No, I love it. I love it. But, yeah, no, the change that I was thinking of the most, really, is that when I was about 14, 15, I decided to start wearing what I wanted to wear and clothes that I actually wanted to look like, which, you know, at the time I was just growing my beard through. And all these changes were happening in my body without my consent, you know, puberty, all of this. I'm a mixed race kid from Bristol on a council estate at the time. And I just suddenly decided to start wearing dresses and skirts and makeup and sequins and crop tops and really ghastly, awful outfits that I adored. And it was, without a doubt, the biggest change, I think, not even of my young life, of my life today.
What was the catalyst for that change? Was there something you saw? Was there someone you saw that made you want to do it? Or, like, was there anything?
Yeah. Oh, my God, this is so cliche. But I was in a school panto.
Love it. Love it.
And they wanted me to audition as, like, the prince. But there was, like, this witch character that I was like, she seems way more fun. And I asked my drama teacher, I was like, hey... I pulled her aside. I was like, hey, do you think that, like, I could go for the role of witch? And she was like, yeah. And so I went for it. Absolutely killed it, obviously. And then, Prince isn't really my bag, but, like, glamorous witch. I think I turned her into, like, what did I call her? I called her, like, the Gaga witch. And she only sung, like, jazz versions of, like, Lady Gaga songs in the thing. It was very cliche. It was bad.
It sounds incredible.
I haven't came out at this point, but clearly I was just saying, right, I don't need to.
This is me coming out. Yeah, which exactly. Is that? Yeah.
And I for that show, I had to, you know, wear a dress and outfit. I picked it all, you know. I picked all the outfit. And then it was, before we were doing the live showing, all the girls that were in our class were like, oh, the football boy, like, the boys were coming to watch it.
Right.
And it didn't click. You know, I was in rehearsals, loving it with all the drama kids. And then it clicked, oh my God, people are going to see me. And I remember absolutely, like, freaking out, like, panicking, not even being able to talk. And my teacher was like, what's up? You're, like, normally so confident. I was like, everyone's going to, like, laugh at me and I'm going to get bullied. I can't do it. And she was like, does it feel good though? And I was like, oh my God, yeah, like, I love this. And she goes, then you should do it. And I went out on stage and it was really interesting because at first, you know, there was definitely whispers, but then because the performance was funny and the performance was good and they were laughing, like, with me. And so I think it was that made me then be like, realize, oh, this didn't just feel good because you were on stage. Like, you enjoyed what these clothes made you feel like. You enjoyed expressing yourself. And, you know, going out on the council estate was not the same reaction as that, but it was... Because I'd had that first response, I could kind of build it in myself, you know?
Yeah. And interesting that took place, that kind of acceptance and validation of you being who you wanted to be took place on stage. And then you ended up carrying on a lot of your work being on stage.
Yeah.
Is there something in that, do you think, that is like
100.
The association? Yeah.
Yeah, 100. I think that on stage, you get to be the things that I think you're punished for in the streets. You know, and I soon realised that on the streets, all the things that I was being looked at and targeted for, grand gestures, my performativity, my gestures, all of that was a plus on the stage. And so for me, it felt really natural to go to the stage because I got to, people say you go on stage and then you pretend, you know, like, I remember acting in my first show and everyone was like, oh, you're pretending. I was like, maybe I'm actually being as honest as I can be. That what you can't be when you're on the street. Do you know what I mean?
Right.
I think that honesty is reduced in the world. You know, like, people go to underground bars, and I remember first coming across, like, queer bars and queer clubs in London. And I think it really suits that. I wish they weren't all in basements, but it suited it. And I remember going down, I was like, oh, upstairs in the real world, people can't be this full of them. They can't be this full of self. And here you can, you know?
Yeah. It's such an interesting flip, isn't it? The idea of pretense, leaving that behind and walking onto the stage to be your truth.
Yeah. Oh my God, I go on the tube. Well, I don't anymore. In the alternative life that we went on the tube, and I see those men in suits going to work. I'm like, they're pretending. They're doing some show too, right? It's always the performance is put on us. But I look at them and then I'll see them in the clubs on the Friday night. You know, I'll see them at Saturday at the RVT and I'll be like, oh, you were playing the game too, you know?
I watched your TED Talk. Travis Alabanza, listeners, has done an incredible TED Talk, which you should all go and watch. But I was really struck by how you really simplified your idea of trans at the start, of what it means to be trans and what it means to not be trans. And you talked about the rules and consent. Would you mind telling us again? Because I just loved how you talked about it.
Thank you. God, that's a throwback, isn't it? Well, it feels like it is. But so I think that to understand trans, you've got to also understand cisgender, which is the opposite of trans. And, you know, at birth, everyone, whether you're trans or not, is assigned something without their consent, either male or female, based on looking at your external organs, or sometimes with intersex people deciding. And then trans just means that in whatever shape or form, you don't feel like you are that thing that you were assigned at birth. Mm-hmm. And cisgender just means that you are comfortable with what you were assigned at birth. And I think that's an easier way of doing it because it allows people to not have to then go, well, I'm not a man, so I'm a woman, or this. I just go, well, I know I'm not this boy thing that was told of me. And that's all you kind of need to know, you know?
Yeah, yeah. It's a really simplified and really like straightforward explanation. I really liked it. Was there a moment for you, Travis, where when you realised you didn't want to follow those rules, you didn't want to be assigned those rules of gender, and can you remember it?
Sometimes I think in these kind of questions, you make up a response that's like super clear. Whereas actually it's probably a load of moments that lead to something, you know, like maybe it was PE classes and being like, this doesn't feel right. Or maybe it was when my beard first came through. But none of those times I went, aha, and then started quoting Judith Butler and was ready to go. But it was actually like, I think a big moment for me was first seeing someone else that had said no. Like I went to, oh my God, I'm rolling out so many cliches in this interview. You can tell I haven't done it in a while. I went to California when I was 18.
Interested in this.
Yeah, so I was like kind of, I would say struggling with like lots of my identities. I was, you know, coming into maybe, I was always have to be racially conscious, but I was struggling with what being queer meant is in terms of exclusion in like the black circles I had been in. And I also wasn't finding really solace in like the white people I knew. And I was just struggling. And my brother could kind of see that I was struggling. And he was older than me. And he said, look, there's this camp in America. And I was like, I'm not going to a freaking summer camp. He's like, no. Like, it's by this feminist called Mia McKenzie. Read some of her stuff. And I started reading her stuff. And I've always been into books from like a really young age. And she was this incredible theorist, basically, that was talking about black queer life. And she was saying, I've got this camp where I'm going to bring all these black queer people together so we can talk about things. And I was like, I can't go. And they were like, fundraise. And so I fundraised. It was really scary. And looking back, I'm like, how? I think I was on such a tunnel to like find something and whatever. And I go there to this camp. And it's like not the cliches, but also the cliches. It's beautiful and not at the same time. And then they do a pronoun circle where they say your pronouns. I go, what's a pronoun? And all these people were like, you don't know what a pronoun is? I was like, no, what is this? You know, I don't know all of this. And it's, and this person was like, all right, them, they. And I was like, what? And I got it wrong. I misgendered them so many times, but I was just learning. And we finally chatted on the second week. I was like, can I ask, like, what is that? Like, what is going on? They were like, well, you know, gender and all these things. I was like, yeah. And they're like, I just opt out. I don't want to do it. And I was like, wait, what? And they were like, I just don't want to do it.
I just love that.
And I was shocked. I was like that. I was like, you can do that. And they were like, well, no, the world's still going to do it to you. But you can start internally with you. Does it make you feel more relaxed? And at first, obviously, like many things that you're afraid of, I ran from it. I was like, oh, cool. That's good for you. I respect that. And then I remember getting the plane home and just being like, oh my God, all of my brain time before that was taken up with this question of what I am. Yeah. But all of that was about man or woman. And I just suddenly relaxed when I was like, that doesn't have to be in my thing. There's so many things more interesting about me than what gender I'm deciding I am, you know?
Yeah, yeah. What a freedom. Like, what a thing to learn at that really formative age when in that place in your life of huge, like, transition, like, hormonally, like, physically, everything's changing. To have that door opened, wow.
Yeah, it was... I look back and I'm so lucky I had it early on because it meant I could find other things about me that were not that. And I see, you know, easily I could have went into now still being weighed down by like all these things. And that's not to say I'm not still weighed down by different things. Of course, it's not this rosy thing. You know, we're always still gendered. Just because you opt out doesn't mean it's not there constantly to you. But the key thing was that consent thing, right? Of like, learning that even if all these things were happening to me, I first have the choice to decide who I am for myself, you know? And that was a huge shift, you know?
Mm. Yeah. And how did your family react then? How did your brother... I mean, it sounds amazing that your brother made you aware of this place in the first place.
Yeah, my brother was really on it. I'm really lucky. Like, I only grew up with my mum and my brother in the house.
Yeah.
And I'm lucky that I think... because I made so many outward signs from an early age, I imagine what I hear is like they did all of their processing then. So by the time that I was coming round processing myself, they'd already done like what I imagine was the kind of readjustment. And so I kind of have only ever felt love and support from them. You know, it took time to get used to language and, you know, all those things. But for me, that stuff always is second. You know, I know for some people language really matters and I understand why it does. Mm. But for me, I'm about the feeling that I'd want from my family is far more important. And so, yes, my mum might slip up on the terminology or the words or whatever. Mm. You know, I'm sure if we brought her to one of my, like, university lectures I go to or do or whatever, there'd be people writing down all the things she's done wrong. But to me, the feeling of support and love was always there from her. And that's more way more important to me, you know.
And do you think that has bolstered you to be able to be the person you are today?
Yeah. Yeah, 100. That's what I think makes me emotional about what's going on in the UK right now for trans people and trans youth and all these debates is because it's not a coincidence that I'm able to work, have a career, sit here talking to you. It's because I was lifted up rather than halted. My life wasn't put on hold for my changes, you know? Like, I wasn't stopped from them, so I didn't have to do them now, you know? I was allowed to do it with everyone else changing and finding themselves. And so I think that's what gets lost in this whole, you know, awful debate around trans kids and trans youth is that we're delaying their, like, start at life and at confidence, you know?
Mm. Because I can imagine if you are in a state of suspension in that way where you know that you feel like you're in the wrong body and you want to be in a new body, but you're not able to proceed, life... You're in purgatory of some sort, I can imagine.
Yeah, you're in a graze. I was definitely in a muted space. That's what it is, like a muted space. You don't feel fully present at any time because half of your thoughts are on something else, at least for me. You know, everyone's different. But, you know, I think from talking to a lot of my friends, it's that same thing. It kind of hazes your ability to connect. And so I think that's what we're holding. You know, people always talk, are so fixated on the physical aspects of transition when it comes to trans people.
Right.
But I often think that that's easy for people to fixate on that because then they can make it a spectacle. But what we're actually talking about is people being full persons, emotionally, being able to find other things that aren't their transness. That can only happen once we're comfortable with our transness, you know?
Speaking about those arguments that are so loud and so prolific everywhere, and you know, you have a number of women's names that crop up quite a lot, you know, radical traditional feminists. Why do you think these people have a problem with trans women in women's spaces? What is their problem with that?
How long is a piece of string of the podcast? You know, I think it's...
I wish you could have seen Travis there. It would have been really good.
I think it's complex, you know, and I can't speak for every person. I think some people come for it through different ways, you know. I think there's a lot of radicalization happening online about lots of topics, a lot of polarization happening about lots of topics. I do think it stems from fear, which is valid, but I think it stems at a fear of violence that is real to women of all genders, cisgender women or trans women. But male violence and patriarchy is so much harder to hold. It's so much harder to tackle. It's so much harder to grasp. We would have to look at our bosses, our dads, our businesses, our structures, our banks, all these things that men run. So much easier, I think, to stamp out a small minority of people that trigger something in us, that remind us of something. So much easier to direct our hate there. I think that there's a confusion of, like, wanting to have control. I think that, like, so much of feminist history is about autonomy and consent. But also, also if we look at, like, when women fought for votes in both UK and US, part of that campaign was also saying which type of women could have that vote. You know, black women were sold, they couldn't. So there's a long history of feminism pushing the rights of certain people and not other people, you know? And so I think this is another example of that. I think that the media has done an incredible job at swinging up fear in people. And I don't think it's a coincidence that a lot of this started, like we saw an increase in these media tabloids the same time that Brexit was being campaigned and happening for. I think that it's a very clever distraction technique from governments and equality ministers to focus on a really small minority in the UK rather than look at the huge, massive issues that are affecting all women, rather than look at domestic violence centres actually being shut down by a Tory government. Liz Truss blows up and says, let's debate the 1% being in these centres that we're shutting down. You know, I think it's really missing out the context of the wider things, you know, like, I just wish the attention was directed elsewhere. Solidarity is always much more powerful than division.
I like my friend Mary. We talk about it a lot, and she's just like, just be sound. She's like, just be safe. Legit. Like, just be sound. Legit. Like, people are people. Just let people just be who they want to be. Like, it's literally that simple. Like, it feels like when she kind of dumbs it down in that way, but it is kind of quite profound. It is a lot of people fighting to be themselves and to have, as you say, autonomy in who they are. And there's a sadness to it that there's so much fighting and people feel so threatened by it, right?
It's so sad because then you don't get to enjoy the joy that's brought by, like, meeting different kinds of people, you know?
Right.
I think that that is what is tough, is my experience of trans people in my life is that creativity, funny, joyful, like, energy, like, it's positive. Yeah. And then everything public is a debate. And I'm like, this is so boring. We could definitely move on to something else, you know?
Let's talk about you and when you, your second change, because that's a lovely time to go to that, which feels like a really positive and joyful time in your life. When you went to uni and dropped out of uni.
Well, my brief cameo at university.
I love that cameo.
Yeah, I did a brief appearance there. Yeah, my brief cameo at university. I moved to London. It was the only option for me. Like, I knew, and I was kind of using university and the maintenance grant to be able to explore London. That was over it. Like, I never had dreams of, like, uni. It was more, how do I get money to get to London? Max out the maintenance grant and the student loan. And I was at King's and I hated it, really. Like, I hated the university aspect, but also I was loving London. I'd found, like, queer clubs for the first time. I'd found, like, queer performers. I was going on stage a bit just on the weekend and I absolutely loved it. But then I had this degree kind of holding me back. And in my family, like a lot of working class families, I think that you got to work really hard to get out of it. And so my mum had instilled with us from a young age, I don't care what you do, but you have to go to school and then you have to get a job. And being an artist did not count as that, you know? So I didn't really know what it was. But I remember doing a show at the RVT, my first, like, headline show where it was me, and it was, like, packed and loads of people and everyone was being like, when's your next show? And I was like, oh no, I've got my exams. And they were like, what? Why are you doing exams? Like, this is what you should be doing. This is what you should be doing. And I was like, no. And I rang my mum up and I was like, what would you feel if, you know, I took a break from university? And my mum's someone that always supports me, always says yes. And she goes, absolutely not. And it was the first time she'd ever like said no. I rang my brother. Yeah. He was like, that would be the biggest mistake you could do. And it was really clear from like family members that have never done that. I remember being like outside the library at King's, watching all these people go past, being absolutely miserable, also knowing I was going to fail my exam too. And then just going, fuck it. Like, I'm going to quit. Like, I don't want to do this. I'm going to quit. And that for me was a huge shift and a huge change because, again, it's about like doing what you want for you. And, you know, my family were really disappointed. I remember like them saying, we can't lie, we're really disappointed.
That must have been scary for you to feel like you kind of, gone against their wishes in that way.
Absolutely. Especially because, like, I think my mum had worked so hard on her own to make sure that her kids wouldn't be in the state that we were in growing up, of wealth and all of this, like, not having it. And she saw, you know, going to university is the way to get money, basically. And then when I go, not only am I dropping out, she goes, to do what? I go, to be a performer in clubs. She goes, how much are you getting paid for your last club gig? I go, that's not important. It's not what I could get paid. She was like, is it triple figures? I was like, absolutely not. It's not triple figures. You know, it's £40 and then I spend it on the drinks. But I wasn't telling her this. I was like, well, I'm investing. I'm investing what I get into costume, into outfits, you know. And she just didn't get it, you know. She only really understood my job about a year ago, to be honest. It was really scary, but I told my mum and my brother that I was never going back. But actually what I did, which is like the less badass story, is that I technically went on a year break, but I told everyone I was quitting.
Right.
But I said,
so you had that safety net if you needed it. Yeah.
And I wrote in my diary, I said, if I can't pay rent in a year, then you've got to go back.
Yeah.
But I told all my family and everyone that I'd quit.
Yeah.
But I told my tutor at the time, who already was, when I turned up, I remember turning up to my tutor to tell them I was quitting uni. And I'm like, I haven't seen you all year. I had assumed you already left. Standard.
So what was happening? So you mentioned kind of headlining a show at the RVT. What is the RVT? Is it the Royal Victoria?
Royal Vauxhall Tavern, yeah.
Vauxhall Tavern, of course. Yeah.
Yeah.
So you're headlining shows. And what are you doing in those shows? And what age are you at this point? Like 19 or something?
20.
20?
20.
Okay.
Good question on what I'm doing in those shows. Still don't really know. you know, I don't know what I was... I really don't know what I was doing, but, like, I guess political commentary, but using...
So
like,
it's you alone,
just
monologues.
Me alone. And yeah, I used these, like... It was weird shit. It was, like, Milk had made a resurgence in the performance art kind of space in clubs, so everyone was pouring milk on everything. And so it was kind of that kind of stuff, you know? I was pouring milk on myself, using projections, chatting about shit. At that time, I was using Grindr conversations that I'd had with people online.
Amazing.
And I'd been print screening all the times they'd been like racist or horrible, and using that to make like comedic text or shows or whatever.
Right.
Looking back on it, I cringe, but at the time it was like, felt good or whatever. I don't know, I was finding myself, you know, and people just really liked it. I think that even though it wasn't long ago in time, you know, I'm a baby, I'm young, but like, I think we think because of what we're looking at now in terms of diversity and stuff that must have been happening for ages. But even 6-7 years ago on the scene, you wouldn't really get a black queer person on a lineup in the RVT often at all.
Wow.
And you wouldn't really get more than one of us. And so when I first hosted the RVT, I made all of my support acts also black. And it was the kind of first kind of time they were having a whole black takeover for the whole month. And I remember turning up on the first Tuesday, and I'd booked like a queer rapper. I'd booked like Carnage, who's amazing. Sorry, you should shout him out. You should check him out now. He's incredible. I booked like a black drag queen, a black like circus act. And the RVT were a bit nervous, I think, you know, but supportive.
Yeah.
All these queues out the door, full of all these people that had never came to the RVT before. All these different black queer people coming because they'd heard that was the show. And that kind of momentum, I think, helped me be like, oh, I've got something a point of view here that is being valued way more than in this classroom across the bridge, you know.
And let's talk about the kind of bridge then from doing these shows at the RVT to then becoming a resident at the Tate, like moving into this kind of high-end art space and how that happens. I heard you on another interview and I thought it was really interesting, the language of art and how you talked about that and the perception of what art is and what art isn't. How did you end up doing, you know, Grindr text to then being, the resident of the Tate, which is all art, obviously, but how did you make that transition?
A lot of vodka shots, probably, somewhere on a drink application. No, you know, that was a weird one. And that came at the right time because I said I needed salary and that job gave me a salary. And so it meant, and it would happen the month before I was meant to have earned enough rent to stay as an artist. And so I'm always thankful for that moment. It came because actually people looking out for me. I think I've given a different answer before where I've put it on me. But actually reflecting, it was from people sharing their resources. An artist called Linda Stupart, who's like a gallery, more like fine artist, right? I just knew Linda as someone that came to the RVT and liked my stuff. Said, I was a resident at the Tate. I should put you forward to apply for it. I went, absolutely, what? Like, no. And they were like, no, you'd be really good at it. And I was like, I make stuff on clubs. And they were like, yeah, they need that. And they sat down, they applied for me. They helped me put in like a good application.
Wow.
I think that sometimes, unfortunately, what it takes is someone from somewhere else opening doors for you and saying, you know, Linda was like, I'm a university educated, posh white person that knew I could always do art. When I hear you speak, I don't think you realise you're doing art. And they were right. Like, I wasn't calling myself an artist at this point. I remember for the application for the Tate, it was the first time I had to like call myself an artist. Yeah. And I was like, oh, this feels horrible. And they were like, you know, they were like, I'll never forget. They said, describe your practice. And I said, what the fuck is a practice? I said, what does that, I'm not practicing anything. Like, what are you doing?
And can you tell us what it is?
Well, like, yeah, exactly. It's horrible, isn't it? It's lofty, isn't it? They mean, what is your work, basically? That's what I want. Like, what do you do? Like, I
was like, yeah. And how did you narrow that down into like a short paragraph? Like,
I made up loads of shit. Yeah.
I mean, like, I think that's a lot of it, though,
yeah,
isn't it?
It's kind
of like
bullshit.
How you speak around it.
Yeah. I bullshit. I would never speak about my practice like that now. But I looked and I saw the words and I was like, I can do that. And I just made up crap. Now I don't bother with that. But I think that's because I had to learn. You know, I opted in and then went, oh, actually what I was doing before felt good.
Yeah.
But going through that kind of world, seeing how people talk about it, I'm like, I want my mum to be able to read what I'm doing and to go, okay, cool. And I don't need to hide it and all this other stuff, you know. But at the time, I was happy to be on PAYE, you know.
Yeah. And your mum must have been gassed at this job. I mean, what a job to tell your mum you got, nah?
She was...
Well, maybe the salary? Was she excited
was
about
the salary?
She was
still a bit hung up on me being an artist at this point. I can't lie. She was happy, but I think she was cautious, you know. It was funny. She came up to watch me like a year later in, I was playing Amyl Nitrate in the remake of Derek Jarman's Jubilee, the theatrical show. And I thought, this is going to be, my face was on posters, amazing reviews. I was like, this is going to be the moment where she goes, maybe my kid is like doing it. And she still said at the end of the conversation, she goes, so are you planning to go back eventually? Like, is this? And I said, I was like, Mum, that ship has sailed. But she's all right now. I did a show in Bristol Burgers last year. And
did she like that?
She loved it. And she came and she saw everyone's reaction and she saw like the book and people like coming and traveling from different, and she turned and she goes, oh, I'm really proud of you. And I was like, thank you, Mum. And she goes, I don't think I really understood it, but this is like proper, isn't it? And I was like, yeah, I think this is a bit proper now. And she was like, yeah.
Travis.
Yeah, it was really special having her at the show. It was like beautiful, actually. And I'm so nervous. And my director was like, I've never seen you this nervous. I was like, it's my mum. Like, I'll be able to tell. She doesn't hide a thing. You know, she's a very strong, loud, confident black woman. She don't hide when something's bad, when I look bad. And she was so positive. And then it paused and she goes, I would change the shoes though.
That I can do.
That I can do, exactly.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, obviously you were going to end up with all of your mom's, you know, being so influenced by your mom, being a grafter and a worker, and you just did it your way, like.
Exactly. Yeah. And that's what I try. She can see it now, you know, especially now I'm in a place where, you know, I can support my mum, which is, I think, a dream for most, any child, but especially single parent families. You know, I think you really see your mum hustle when it's just like, people go, oh, you work in this and this. I think some people, you just know that grafting's the only option, whether that's working in a shop or a cafe or whatever. And I think that we've made up this lie that art is only allowed to be for these certain types of people.
Mm.
And no, like nothing like that, you know, none of that, you know. So yeah, it is grafting.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
So Burgers, your show that you mentioned, a huge success for you and ended up being in South Bank Centre, am I right in saying that?
Yeah.
And like when you read about you, again, you know this already, but listeners won't. There's a lot of firsts. There's a lot of, you know, Travis Alabanza, you know, doing the first, being the first, you know, black trans artist to be in the South Bank Centre, you know, all of this stuff. How was, like, I've got so many questions about Burgers, but how, like, looking back at it now, having had time to reflect, how important was that for you in terms of your journey, that whole experience?
Oh, my God. Undescribable, like, joy from pain moment. And even with the first thing, like, I get kind of weird when people say that, because I don't think there's any way to know. I'm not interested in first and all.
Yeah, it's healthy to not get too deep in that stuff. I get that.
But I think for me, Burgers was so important because it was my first time where I paused from the club work. So I was like always doing 10-minute gigs, 10-minute slots, walking around doing 7 shows a night, going different trips in London, you know, getting, my fee went from 40 quid to 90 quid, you know, like moving around, but still hustling. And I could see that my work was trying to go somewhere else. And Burgers was great because someone gave me time to sit and write rather than constantly having to be make things for a club. Actually pause. What does it look like to take up a longer amount of space? Learning that your stories don't just have to be, they can be in the underground, they can be in that, but they can also not be if you don't want to be, you know. And at this point, you know, I'm going around London looking, as I do, gender non-conforming, and part of what I was really having to come to terms with of how unsafe that was, you know, how unsafe it was to be walking outside. And I was so upset that me and a lot of my friends that were in the clubs would then have really hard daytimes looking like we do in the clubs at night going to the day. So I knew I wanted to talk about that. I knew I wanted to make a show that was documenting that. And I thought, well, this burger did get thrown at me. It feels like an event that is staying with me emotionally. How do I turn it into something? And then it actually came about because I couldn't cook at the time. And so I was like, well, if I'm going to do this show, I also need to gain something. So I'm going to learn how to cook. So that's how I I'm going to make a burger on stage and talk about this stuff. And, you know, yeah, it did change. It did change my life. Not even career. Well, I don't. That stuff, whatever, it changed my life because it was the first moment where I'd done jobs before, I'd been in acting stuff, but it was the first time when I went, I'm actually all right at this. I can do this. And I'm not more than that. I'm having fun. Mm. And I remember being like, this is what I want to do, you know?
Mm. And the very kind of physical act of, you know, making a burger on stage, but also reliving this experience that was painful for you. Of having someone throwing a burger at you on London Bridge, Waterloo Bridge, sorry. And then the kind of impending silence afterwards, and the lack of reaction, the lack of help and support you got from the passers-by at the time. Like, how was that? I was thinking about that when watching the clip of Burgers, like, again and again, having to relive that and explain to people how you feel and how they didn't react and how violence is silence, like you said. Does that, how does that affect you?
Yeah. The show was kind of made in this, like, I always described it as like this kind of box that opens, like a box physically opens at the beginning. I come out of a big box and then that box closes. The way the show was structured, it kind of did that. At the beginning, it's a lot of opening. But I mean, spoiler alert, but I mean, it's probably not going to be back for a while, is because I invite a white cisgender man every night on stage from the audience to help me make the burger, the show very quickly becomes less about me and all about him. The man does so much more emotional work in that show than I do.
Right.
And also the bits that become tough, because the show ends with recreating that act and hoping that someone from the audience will stop it. And 99% of the time, an audience members come and stop the burger then being thrown. It means that I get to see in front of me what I didn't get to see on Waterloo Bridge. And the audience get to see that too. So they get to see what standing up for someone looks like. And for me, and the audience, that's a really powerful moment. And I think that's why so many of us, I don't cry in the show, but sometimes I do. Sometimes I'll see it happen. Like, sometimes there'll be a time when a man I've really connected with will be asked about throwing the burger, and I'll think, oh my God, maybe this is the time where no one's going to stop. And then you see this person that's been very uncomfortable at the beginning of the show stand up and go, actually, no, 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 this isn't right. And then I just am like, how real is that? That's not theatre anymore. This is real. And I can go through the pain every night because at the end of the show, I know I'm about to get what I don't get in the streets. It comes back to what I said earlier, you know, going on stage to do the honest stuff, not to do the fake stuff.
It's mad, isn't it? So you've taken something that's happened to you and you're turning it around night after night after night. Not like that's...
Yeah, we made a lot of burgers. vegans didn't love my show, and I did. I just want to say, I've never said, but I've been thinking about it. Suppose we did try and do a vegetarian.
You do a veggie burger, yeah.
Yeah, we did try, but it just when it
does
cooks,
it not throw as well.
Yeah, it doesn't throw as well. Don't look as good. It doesn't stink out the room. Like part of it when I was doing the small rooms before we were in, like, you know, the South Bank or whatever, in the box rooms, everyone stunk of meat, and I loved it. You leave, and I was like, this is great. At that time, my only like audience were all these queer lefties, and I was like, you're all leaving smelling of meat, perfect. You hate me right now.
Now you know how I felt. So that's Burgers, and then Overflow, you know, that's, you know, again, first time like looking you up beyond like seeing you on social media, you are a playwright.
Yeah. Don't troll me like that, Annie. Stop trolling me out. No, I'm not.
You're a playwright
no,
now.
No, I was just building street cred throughout all of this. Don't say something dirty as that.
But it's real proper, like, Bush Theatre, like, big theatres, you know. And yeah. I was gutted for you when, obviously, lockdown happened and that had to stop. It's going online now, right? It's going to be streaming really soon.
Yeah, next week. I find it hard to reflect on things when I'm still kind of in it with Overflow.
Yeah.
But, yeah, it was my first time doing something where I'm not on stage, so I'm writing it for someone else. So I guess they start calling me a playwright. And yeah, I guess it is. It's a play. It's a bloody play.
Yeah.
Overflow is, you know, it's set in a women's bathroom, and it's about a trans woman that is trapped in a woman's bathroom, and she uses the time that she's trapped to look over her whole life in toilets. And so she traces through her life in toilets. And what for me, again, it was about, you know, they've got the newspaper columns, they've got all these places they can be loud, but where can we speak back? And actually, it's, I think people come thinking it's going to be a debate. And actually what Overflow is, for me, is an ode to club toilets. It's an ode to like the makeup lessons you learn at toilets. There's an ode to festival toilets. You know, for me, it's about all the other things that make up this person's life. Mm. Why is now she being stopped from entering this space? And so what I loved about Overflow is I'm always surprised by something when things come out. Is that, yes, it was about the trans debate, but so many people were just talking about how it made them miss clubbing, how it made them miss festivals. My friends came to see it and they said, oh, this is the first show I've seen of yours that feels like not just the you that is really smart and talks all these things, but the you that I know from Glastonbury back when you were 15. And yeah. I was like, yes, right, I miss raves. That's what this is about. That was what this was. So Overflow is kind of that.
And is there like an intention on your part to have the audiences feel a certain way when they leave Overflow?
Yeah, definitely. I want them to feel joyful. I think people leave feeling joyful and empowered. Whereas a lot of my work, challenge is like the first thing I think of. With this, actually, yeah. I wanted to leave something on a high note because of the year we'd had and everything. But I think, I think Overflow feels a bit punk, actually. It feels like a bit of like a, and punk feels like something that bridges lots of differences together, but without talking about it as much. It just does it. So that's what I think for Overflow.
Yeah, I read the whole script last night and I absolutely loved it. And I can't
wait
to see it.
They sent you the script?
They sent me the script. Is that allowed?
No, that just makes me nervous.
Well, you're a playwright now. That's, you know, people read scripts.
That's what they do with it.
Yeah, I loved it. Absolutely loved it. So I wanted to ask you about, you know, representation, because it strikes me that you are someone who is a, you know, a positive force for the trans community. You're someone who is out there doing it, as you say, talking about the challenges of being trans, but also just talking about the joyful things about being trans as well. Do you feel that? Do you feel that you are a voice now? I mean, you're only bleeding, what, 25? Like, you know, it's a big responsibility to take on. But have you felt that, you know, in the last few years as your voice has become louder? Not louder, more heard.
Do you know what? This is being real. This pause has really helped me readjust my relationship to that.
Yeah.
Because I think it can be quite, I find it quite terrifying, actually, if I'm honest.
Yeah, I can understand that.
Yeah, I think there's so many trans people that I know, but there is so few of us that have access to certain things. And that's dependent on, like I said, family support, or it's dependent on how we speak, how we put ourselves across, our shade, all these different things that have meant that I'm in the situation I'm in. And I think when you're from a community that doesn't have a lot of access, you know, trans people, particularly trans people of colour, some of the most highest rates of unemployment, highest rates of homelessness, all these different things. Mm. I think it can be a lot of pressure then when you suddenly appear to the world of having beat whatever that is. Even though obviously internally in your life, you know that you're walking outside, you're still getting crap on the street, you know that you're still having to manage all these things. And so it used to exhaust me a lot trying to please everyone and trying to be like, okay, I need to be constantly thankful, constantly grateful and constantly in service, I think. Mm. And then I did a bit of a dive for all the things I've ever said publicly. And I said, oh, I've actually never called myself an activist. And I've actually never called myself a visibility. I've never used these words. This was...
That's other people putting those words
other
on
people.
You. Right.
I've just made work. And that was projected onto it. And I said, oh, I don't know if I need to hold as much. So I don't know about that question yet. I think that's one that it's like a live one.
Yeah, and it's probably not a comfortable thing to think about. It, you know, to have to think about your place in a community and how you're thought of and how you're perceived is not necessarily a comfortable thing to think about, is it?
And I think
my bad.
No, not at all that. But I think, you know, everyone deals with it in different ways. I mean, I don't need to tell you what it means to have different variations of public perception, you know? It's, and you know, I'm receiving it on a smaller scale, but a concentrated scale because there is so few of us in public. Mm. But all I try and remember is that's not what you're doing it for. That wasn't a thing that you thought about. What is the thing that you actually care about? I care about making good work and I care about making more jobs for us so that more people are making good work that look like me and don't look like me, just all different types of trans people. So if I continue with that, then the side effect of that will also be I'll be less pressure because there'll be more of us making jobs, you know? That's why I said I didn't want to... The first thing when I submitted the script for Overflow, they were like, oh, we guess you'll be in it. And I went, oh, no. They went, why? I was like, we've seen me in a show. You know, that's why we did an open call for Overflow.
Because
we wanted to get... We got people that were mums, people that had just gotten out of prison, all these different kinds of people auditioning. Mm. And I said, great, now here's a huge list of people for when we want to cast our next show. Nothing's ever healthy when it's on one person in any aspect of life. Nothing's healthy on... We shouldn't be putting people on podiums because then people just fall. Mm. Why are we like looking up to people and instead just flattening it all out, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Let's talk about the third change. The thing that you would most like to change.
What was my favourite change?
in your life or the world moving forward. So you talked about social media.
Oh, God, did I? What, probably having a day
You basically said something along the lines of like trying to not be so tied to social media, I think.
Yeah,
all
I think
the time.
That sounds like me.
Yeah?
Yeah. What's your relationship with social media?
It's so conflicted. So I feel shame sometimes with how I can be reliant on social media, on dopamine, on likes. And I've really fought hard to like put my phone in a drawer recently, not take it to my bedroom at the weekends, put it away. But it's constant. It's constant. It's the thing me and my partner argue the very most about. Get off your phone. Get off your phone. My kids, tell us to get off our phones. That's a fucking shameful situation. but yeah, it's hard. I mean, they're addictive things. And, you know, I think everyone goes through that. So
yeah, I think. Yeah. 100. I think that like I am just wanting out from it for now, you know. I want to build a way where I'm not as reliant on it. I think that because I didn't go to art school and because I was not in those clubs, those places, I built a social media following to convince theatres and audiences to book me. So a lot of the times in my first kind of gigs, when I did a tour around Europe, and it looked from the outside really big. This was like 3 or 4 years ago, because it was all these popular venues. But actually it was because I put out on my social media, if you want me in your city, go and hound your venue to have me. And right. So that's how I got gigs at the early days. So I used to be really reliant on it
It was strategy.
Yeah, I was like, the art world's not going to pay attention to me, so I need to build my audience first so that then they listen.
Yeah.
But I think what that's created with me is this like tether that I like feel really heavily like I need to be there all the time. And I think I've never spent this much time on a screen as we all have, you know, probably in this last year. And without all the other aspects of my life that we normally have, you know, friends, going out, like audiences, like real life people, all I'm doing online is comparing myself all day. And that's
poisonous
and never fruitful for you or the person you're comparing yourself to.
No,
you build all these projections up of these people that you're looking at. And I could see it was happening because I remember like looking at a specific account and making this really not healthy comparison. Then I paused and went, wait, you know them, you know that this isn't true what you're saying.
Yeah.
And I was like, whoa, social media made me forget that I actually knew who this person was. I want to limit the amount of projections placed on me, but also I want to stop projecting so much onto other people that I don't know. We don't know each other, you know?
Yeah. I think that's a very, very relatable thing to want to do in 2021. I think a lot of people feel the same. I have this theory that like in 10 years, we'll have like people who are off-grid consultants who you pay to basically take you totally off-grid, and it will be the thing to be off-grid.
Oh my God, I'm hoping so. I'm hoping we all go back to the newsletter. That's it. That is it.
Love a newsletter. Simple emails. Yeah, perfect.
Exactly.
Travis, so looking forward to 2021. Obviously, you're in the middle of Overflow. Is there things with this reflection that you've had that you are kind of, that are kind of simmering in your brain? Things that you want to express, things that you want to write about and create through your art?
Yeah, definitely, and this interview brought it out more. I'm definitely wanting to. I've moved back to my hometown, Bristol, during this.
No way.
Yeah, and I'm like 5 minutes away from my mum for the first time in like 7 years. And so we've been hanging out loads, going on walks and stuff. I think that there's something to write about with her, with my mum. I want to bring my mum into it. And I'm all about unconventional people on the stage. Single mums. I've been thinking a lot about single mums, and especially with what we've seen in the news, like recently with the food, that was really like a tough watch for so many of us, and so much empathy to people, but also just a remembrance of like when that was your life. That's what I've been thinking about a lot. Just like changes in that way, you know, like I think about my mum a lot, maybe just because of this interview. I feel like she came up a lot in it, you know?
She sounds like an incredible person. Listen, Travis, thank you so much. I really appreciate your generosity and your time. It's been such a lovely conversation.
Yeah, it's been nice.
Thank you so much to Travis. What a wonderful person. What a deeply intelligent person. And I loved especially what Travis had to say with regards to the idea of acting and how when they initially stepped on the stage, all pretense was gone and their true self was able to come out. I love that kind of beautiful contradiction. And then what Travis spoke about with kind of all those people who are supposed to be living their truths, going to their jobs every day in their suits or whatever, actually them being the actors and living the lies. That's so interesting. So yeah, let us know what you thought of Travis. Share the podcast far and wide, please. Anyone who you know who might be interested in that, who would benefit from learning about the trans experience from someone who lives that experience every single day. Thank you for all of your comments on Bez and of course on Larch Maxi from last week as well. Such big reactions to both of those for different reasons. And yeah, if you're a fan of Changes, please don't forget to rate, review and subscribe. I will be back next Monday with award-winning author and general all-round brilliant woman, Candice Carty-Williams, a darling of the literary world, has written one of the most exciting and talked about books of the last couple of years and has a new one to talk about as well. So Candice Carty-Williams on the show next week. Thank you for listening. This episode was produced by Louise Mason with research from Leila Simone Springer through Rethink Audio. See you next time.